Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette on this Wednesday, June 25th, 2025. Today on the front page, there's a large picture of a group of protesters carrying signs with the heading, Champaign County Workers Represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees demonstrate Tuesday outside the Champaign County Courthouse on the heels of their nearly unanimous decision to authorize a strike against the county if necessary in an effort to negotiate a better contract. Continuing on at the bottom of the front page of the newspaper is an article from Urbana Plan Commission by Jana Wiersema with the title, Permit Sought to Operate Hostel in Former Greek House. Halton Bagley estimates that he stayed in about 100 hostels during his travel abroad. A hostel is geared generally towards a younger crowd, more budget-friendly, he explained, and it's more shared spaces. So whereas a hotel, and I'm just picking random numbers, might cost $200 a night, a hostel bed is substantially lower than that. Bagley's experiences sparked the idea of starting his own hostel one day, and now he hopes to make that dream a reality at a former sorority house on the eastern edge of the University of Illinois campus. The building at 1204 South Lincoln Avenue was occupied by Kappa Delta for nearly a century. In late 2016, the sorority announced plans to leave the Tudor-style house, its home since 1924, for a new building on Armory Avenue. Kappa Delta sold the Lincoln Avenue property in 2017 per county records, and it was later occupied by the Sigma Tau Gamma fraternity. While the building is not a local or national historic landmark, it easily marks the criteria required for either designation. Kevin Garcia, principal planner with the City of Urbana, wrote in a report to the Urbana Plan Commission, which will consider Bagley's request for a special use permit at its meeting on Thursday night. The commission will then pass along a recommendation to the City Council, which makes the final decision on whether to approve or deny the permit to allow the hostel in the University Residential Zoning District. Planning staff advised that the commission recommend approval of the permit, and Garcia wrote that Bagley's proposal would adaptively use an existing architecturally significant building without altering its exterior. He noted that if the permit is granted, Bagley plans to buy the property from current owner Jim Webster and live on site as owner-operator of the hostel, which would be called Chapter. I went to a state university in New York and had a great college experience, and I know how it's a very shaping experience for a lot of America, Bagley said. And then after college, been in kind of corporate America for the past 8-ish years and always did a whole bunch of traveling throughout the time, working remotely. He added that he's had his eye on the U of I for several years and he's been pretty dead set on opening the hostel near the university. Bagley said that some of his target demographics include young people who are in town visiting friends at the U of I, international students who need a place to stay during breaks, and visitors attracted by university events. There's a need for this kind of middle ground that's between your friend's couch, which costs nothing, or a hotel, which can be prohibitively expensive, he said. While prices will vary based on occupancy rates and special events, Bagley said he's looking at a rate of about $35 per night for a bed. He added that hostels provide a community atmosphere where guests can meet new people through common spaces or events such as potlucks. Garcia noted that the proposed hostel would have a maximum capacity of about 60 guests and include 10 private rooms, 10 to 11 shared rooms, 6 full private bathrooms, 2 communal bathrooms, each with 4 showers, 7 sinks, and 3 toilets. Bagley also plans to include a communal kitchen and study/co-working areas. The applicant plans to live in and operate the hostel and will have policies that should make the hostel less of a potential nuisance for neighbors, specifically quiet hours beginning at 10 p.m. nightly, no alcohol on site, Garcia wrote. They will also have a minimum age of 18 to check in, and they will require an ID badge to verify that. Bagley said that assuming the city council grants him the special use permit, he will also need to get the property certified by the building inspector since he's proposing a new use. He will not be renovating the building's exterior, and his changes to the inside will be minor, such as painting, arranging furniture, and adding decor. Bagley's current plan is to move to Urbana in late August if all goes well. From there, he estimates that it will take about 4 to 5 months to set up the hostel. He hopes to open at the start of late spring of 2026 semester, possibly in mid-January. It's been a dream of mine to do this, as I said, and it's kind of all converging, he said. It's going to be a tremendous amount of work, but I think there's a need for it. And when I think about the theme and the brand of my hostel, I want to create a safe place extremely close to the university. Also on the front page, an article about the Champaign County Court from Urbana by Luke Taylor with the title, Civil Suit Against Pavilion Settled. Terms of Final Deal, Not a Matter of Public Record. A $180 million civil suit against a Champaign psychiatric facility has been settled out of court more than a year after it first went to trial. Details about the settlement are not a matter of public record, and neither the plaintiffs nor the Pavilion Behavioral Health System attorney have responded to requests for comment from the News Gazette. However, Champaign County Judge Jason Baum, who presided over the case, said it has been resolved outside of his courtroom. The plaintiff in the lawsuit accused the Pavilion Foundation of negligence after a 13-year-old patient in the psychiatric care facility was raped by another patient in 2020. Tim Cronin, an attorney with the Simon Law Firm who represented the victim's mother, said that the 13-year-old was admitted to the facility's adolescent floor while dealing with depression and mood swings in November of 2020. 6 days later, she was sexually assaulted by another patient. A 16-year-old boy and another teenage patient put toothpaste on the lenses of several surveillance cameras in the adolescent wing before splashing water on the ground. While a Pavilion employee was directed fetching a cloth to clean up the water, Cronin said the boys told the 13-year-old to enter the 16-year-old's room where he raped her. The 16-year-old died in a shooting over 3 years ago, well before his suit went to court. Pavilion staff were unaware of the incident until the girl reported it to a nurse 2 days later and completed a rape kit at the hospital. She had injuries consistent with the assault. The 16-year-old's medical record and Pavilion intake form noted that he had a history of sexual aggression, which Cronin said meant employees would know he needed to be closely monitored. Mike Prangle, an attorney who represented Pavilion at trial, argued that the floor was adequately staffed and that the history of sexual aggression noted on the 16-year-old's intake form was an error. He said that the boy hadn't exhibited any prior behavior indicating that he and his accomplice were going to orchestrate the rape, and that it only happened because they distracted the supervising staff member. Camera feeds were not monitored in real time, and none of the three employees on duty witnessed the boys putting toothpaste over the lenses, though one employee testified she noticed a blur on the camera feed about an hour before the rape occurred and reported it. Some staff members who were on duty testified in court that they did not need additional assistance that night and would have called for it if they had. Others said the Pavilion facility was understaffed and that they felt it was dangerous to have male and female patients housed near each other. The victim, who was 16 by the time she testified, said that she was left struggling with image issues and frequent nightmares. Her mother recalled being told on the phone by a Pavilion employee that male and female patients were housed separately, and said she would have admitted her daughter somewhere else if the answer had been different. This trial carried on for seven days, as lawyers examined and cross-examined 19 witnesses. The jury deliberated over 6 hours before siding in favor of the plaintiff, the victim's mother. That verdict included a ruling that Pavilion would be required to pay a total of $535 million in damages, with $20 million for the girl's loss of a normal life, $40 million for her pain and suffering, and the remaining $475 million in punitive damages. Among post-trial motions filed by the pavilion's attorneys was a request to reduce that number, calling it excessive. After hearing arguments from both sides, Baum ruled that the record-breaking damage amount was indeed excessive. He reduced the punitive damages to $120 million, but did not alter the other damages awarded, saying that there was no evidence that the jury hadn't properly considered the case. Baum agreed the number was large, but said that didn't make it excessive. Great harms demand great awards, he wrote in his decision. Baum also wrote that this court recognizes the enormity of reducing a jury award by well over $250 million with the stroke of a pen, and does not do so lightly. In March of this year, attorneys once again presented the plaintiff and the pavilion in Baum's courtroom in response to a citation to discover the mental health facility's assets. Many of those assets were shared with Pavilion's parent companies, Universal Health Services and Universal Health Services of Delaware, making the determination of whether the company had the funds to pay the damages somewhat more complicated. Now, with the case settled, the examination of assets will not need to continue. We're going to continue on to our communities, section A7, with a large article having a picture of the future business leaders of America clubs from Champaign Central and Centennial High Schools, and they're set to head to California at the end of this month for the group's National Leadership Conference. Large group of very earnest-looking young people, and the title of the article is Testing Their Capability. Future Business Leaders of America, Central Centennial Students Heading to California to Prove Their Business and Marketing Savvy, by Luke Taylor. Two Champaign high schools will be represented at the Future Business Leaders of America National Leadership Conference this year, where they'll compete in all kinds of events using their business and marketing savvy. Not everybody that is part of the FBLA competes, but that is the best part of it, said Eric Fagerlin, a teacher at Central High School. That's where the kids see the most growth in themselves. He and fellow Central teacher Farah Tuttle will join forces with Eric Springer, a teacher at Centennial High School, to take both schools' groups all the way to California this week for the national conference. Our chapters are growing here in Champaign so much, and when you get to the conference, it just blows you away how many people there that there are, Springer said. The teachers will have a chance to meet up with folks in similar positions nationwide and swap ideas, but the real focus of the trip is, of course, their students. Some will compete in role-play events, like Centennial student Natalie Abad, who says Quizlet is coming in handy, prepping to handle situations in sports and entertainment management. He'll also get a real-life example of the output of that line of work when the group takes some free time to attend a Los Angeles Angels game. Priyam Banerjee, another Centennial student, is competing in a similar role-play event for entrepreneurship. Once he gets his prompt, he'll have 20 minutes to prep for a 7-minute presentation. To prepare, I looked at my comments from judges at state, and I found a lot of videos online about other people and their role-plays, Banerjee said. Many of the other students are participating in group events. Matthew Phillip and Soham Garapu from Central have been working on a presentation about their partnership with a real business from India. Before our project, we had a little passion project going on, and it just really fit in for our chapter, Phillip said. It's basically a project where the whole chapter collaborates with a business for the local community. Safa Thamim and Kennedy Vorden from Centennial are partnering on a public service announcement project that led them to put together a 30-second video on healthy workplace habits. Thamim said she suggested to the other members of her group because she enjoys acting and video editing, and the prompt stood out. I thought it would be really fun to do, and it was. We ended up getting fourth place at the state, she said. Hannah Libman and Anaya Ranganari worked together on a social media campaign to promote a nonprofit organization. To prepare, me and my partner have been reviewing the comments that we got from state and then practicing a lot with our advisors and local business leaders, Libman said. It's been really nice to hear their perspectives and take into account what they said. With such a wide variety of competitions, the whole group will have plenty to do at the conference, not to mention all of the educational and social events involved. Borden said those social aspects are one of the things she's looking forward to most. I'm really excited to network, Borden said. Last year I had a lot of fun because we got to meet people from all across the country. The better weather will be really good, too. Garapu agrees and is happy for the chance to travel. I honestly don't get out of Illinois that much, and I feel like all these states, all these people combined, it's going to be a really cool experience, he said. Rangakari, who placed in the top 10 at last year's conference, is most looking forward to the awards show. I remember how fun it was last year, and I didn't feel that confident. I was like, okay, let's get this over with, she said. When I saw my name on the board of top 10, that was the best feeling ever. The group has been working hard to raise funds for the around $1,500 in travel costs for each member and is still looking to partner with any local businesses who are interested in sponsoring them going forward. Any final funds before they head out for Sunday's start of the conference will be appreciated, but the teachers leading the group say that they're already planning ahead for future events as well. Continuing in Section A8 under our communities, an article from Urbana by Jana Wiersema with the title, Normal Educator Chosen as the Next Principal, and this is from the University Lab High School. An educator with a long history of working at laboratory schools has been chosen to lead Uni High. The University of Illinois announced Tuesday that Robert Fitzgerald will serve as the next director and principal of University Lab High School and will start July 1st, pending approval from the U of I trustees. As a widely respected educational leader known for his innovation, mentorship, and inclusive and team-oriented leadership style, Fitzgerald has been asked to build on Uni High's century-long legacy of delivering exceptional learning experiences and advancing educational innovation, university officials said. He will focus on facilitating effective collaborations to strengthen the school's laboratory mission and developing meaningful partnerships across the school, campus, and community. Fitzgerald is currently the assistant principal at the PK-8 Thomas Metcalf Laboratory School at Illinois State University. Before taking on that role in 2023, he previously worked at University High School at ISU for over 20 years. In a number of roles, including faculty member, assistant athletic director, director of student life, and co-chair of the social science department. Fitzgerald has also taught courses at ISU and Illinois Wesleyan University. He holds a bachelor's degree in history as well as a master's and PhD in education, administration, and foundations. Fitzgerald's title will be interim director for education until current director and principal Elizabeth Majors exits her role on July 25th, U of I officials said. Majors, who has led the school for 6 years, plans to return to teaching English. And an article from Monticello by Nora Mayberry from the Monticello Middle School, Garden, a tribute to late library aide's legacy. She would be absolutely thrilled. When Brenda Lambert was the library aide at Monticello Middle School, she would read young adult novels. She wanted to know what to recommend to students when they told her about their interests. But it was more than that. She also wanted to be able to bond with them, strike up conversations with them, and create a safe space for students who needed it. That's who she was. She wanted every child to know that who they were mattered and they belonged. Now, a space at Monticello Middle School will be a constant reminder of that. The revamped Monticello Middle School garden broke ground last week in the courtyard area. Von Lambert, Brenda's husband, wanted to do something to honor his wife, who passed away on February 29th of 2024. This was Brenda's heart and soul, he said. Her heart was with the kids, and her goal was to make sure that every kid felt like they belonged. He donated to the cause and helped secure a $25,000 gift for the Heart of Illinois Foundation and a $25,000 grant from Monticello Area Education Foundation. I grew up as a jock, so going out and shooting hoops before school was natural, Vaughn said. But there are kids where that's not any fun. There are kids where if I had my hands in some dirt and am doing something, that's great. There are kids that if they have a place to sit and read, that's great. This is going to provide for those kids for years to come. Monticello Middle School Principal Mark Hughes said Brenda would love the project. She'd be absolutely thrilled to know what that garden is becoming, he said. It will serve so many purposes, support the garden club, new ag programs, and give our students and teachers a clean, green space to learn. But I think Brenda would be most proud of the environment it will create for those students who follow their path to gather, socialize, read, and enjoy nature. Hughes said a landscape company has been hired to set the foundations, but then students from the middle school and high school will work and complete it. It's a huge group effort. And there's a picture of Mark Hughes, Kristen Poling Wright, Michelle Wilkinson Gross, Von Lambert, Rory Wright, and Adam Clapp as they break ground on the tribute to Brenda Lambert. Next, we have an article from Homer by Dave Hinton, where there's a picture, a bright picture, of a boatload of Prairie Dragon Paddler members docked on a hot Saturday practice. The group, made up of breast cancer survivors, will hold a special 10th anniversary event from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday at Homer Lake, and they are in a canoe getting ready to paddle off. Some happy paddlers here. And it says, breast cancer survivors paddle to recovery. The 10th anniversary event set for Sunday at Homer Lake. Kelly Bradham and Renee Lyle both found motivation from within to make the journey back from breast cancer treatment. For Bradham, it was a desire to help other women going through what she was experiencing. For Lyle, it was her decision to go into the fight to beat breast cancer and not let her emotions take over. It's a shock to get the diagnosis and the treatment and many things you get after the treatment, said Bradham, who was diagnosed in 2012 at age 57. She remembers a pivotal moment in her recovery. I remember being in my bed recuperating. I was thinking then, I want to do something to help others who've been going through the same thing, Bradham said. A psychotherapist, she knows that there are social, emotional, and physical components that are important for recovery. What those going through breast cancer and recovery experience affects not just them, it also affects their family. Bradham said many younger women are being diagnosed with breast cancer. Part of that is because modern medicine is more adept at discovering the disease early. But that doesn't explain why more younger women appear to be getting breast cancer than ever. Researchers have found that the younger the women, the more aggressive the breast cancer. When Bradham was diagnosed and recovering, she said she didn't know another breast cancer survivor. She began to network and pull those like her together. The first time we met for a breakfast, about 26 women showed up and told their stories, Bradham said. We bonded. We're like family. It's a really welcoming, supportive group. For me, emotionally, it felt like it was moving forward. As part of the physical and emotional part of the recovery, Bradham founded the Prairie Dragon Paddlers. Lyle, like Bradham, a Champaign resident, said her involvement with the Prairie Dragon Paddlers has been important in her healing. It helps with your scar tissue, Lyle said. I have all my range of motion in my arm back. She said bonding with the other members has also been important. Lyle might have even surprised herself by how she knuckled down to recover from breast cancer, saying that while she normally is an emotional person, that wasn't the case when told she had been diagnosed with the disease. I went straight into the fight, into fight mode, Lyle said. I just kind of went into what do I have to do to overcome this? Lyle, who was director of marketing and communication for Illinois Human Resources, said even during treatment, which included chemotherapy and radiation, she didn't want to miss work. She only stayed away for 3 weeks after surgery because she had to. Lyle, who was diagnosed in 2022, has been in remission for 3 years, and many people tell her it's her attitude that brought her through it. She credited her friends, family, and the other members of the Paddlers as being vital in her recovery as well. Bradham and Lyle will be part of the special 10th anniversary event for the Prairie Dragon Paddlers, open to the public from 1 to 4 on Sunday at Homer Lake. The group's new dragon boat will be on hand, and people can meet the team and watch a race. Those attending will also get a chance to paddle in the boat with the team. The dragon boat, which is about 40 feet long, has 10 seats, each of which holds 2 paddlers. Both Bradham and Lyle said their involvement with the Prairie Dragon Paddlers has been instrumental in their breast cancer recovery from a physical as well as an emotional standpoint. And we're going to try to squeeze in our J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History editorial before we have to take a break, and its title is The First March on Washington. The American lexicon that once filled with dozens, hundreds of charmingly quaint phrases that have now gone the way of the dodo. A particular favorite was, there was enough food to feed Coxey's army. While your grandparents and great-grandparents would have understood it, saying it these days would be met with a puzzled expression, followed by, who was Coxey? Why did he have an army? And, most practical of all, why was it hungry? All good questions deserve an answer, and believe it or not, they all go back to the very first protest march on Washington more than 130 years ago. Because this group made its way on foot across the country with a shared goal, although it didn't achieve anything its participants sought, it did cause quite an uproar, and it concluded with an incident that left us with that once popular phrase, "This is the forgotten tale of Coxey's army." The economy suffered a nasty downturn in the Panic of 1893. It was the nation's worst financial crisis up to that point. Millions of working people were suddenly unemployed. Suffering was widespread and severe. Some folks wanted immediate action from Washington. They demanded that Congress pass a bill authorizing $500 million to build roads and other public work projects, creating jobs and stimulating the economy. Think of it as a forerunner to FDR's New Deal 40 years later, and they wanted Congress to do it quick. Jacob Coxey was one of the idea's most enthusiastic backers, a 40-year-old sand quarry owner in Massillon, Ohio. He was a dedicated populist with a witty turn of phrase. Though friends and family considered him something of an oddball, his belief that Congress should act to end suffering was sincere. Coxey proposed a radical plan. He would personally lead unemployed men to Washington, where they would march to the U.S. Capitol and present their demands to congressional movers and shakers. It's likely the idea didn't originate with Coxey. 36 groups of out-of-work men around the country were proposing similar steps, but Coxey was among the first, and because he was so quotable, his effort received the lion's share of news coverage. Coxey grandly christened his effort the Army of the Commonwealth in Christ. The press dubbed it simply Coxey's Army. When it set out from Massillon on Easter Sunday of 1894, Coxey was at the head of 100 men, confidently predicting their ranks would swell to 100 by the time they reached Washington. His young wife and their son, Legal Tender Coxey, yes, that was the poor kid's real name, went with him. It was a madcap, haphazard affair from the start. In that long time before social media, it was difficult to get the word out and organize, so different groups started for Washington at different times. As for the logistics, planning wasn't Coxey's forte. He seemed to improvise as the group moved by foot from town to town, camping outdoors and feasting on whatever food local supporters provided. New recruits came in as other protesters dropped out. The whole thing was ragtag from start to finish. However, it did generate a lot of news coverage. In the age of yellow journalism, newspapers eagerly covered the march. Many reports were derisive. The country was laughing at Coxey's army as it plodded eastward. Yet there was also silent anxiety under the surface, a fear that perhaps the marchers would unleash social forces that would prove impossible to control. I'm going to break in right here because we are going to have to take that break and I'm not going to be able to finish it, but I'm going to start our next section of the paper in a couple minutes here with this, the rest of this article. I am sorry I couldn't squeeze it in. So stay tuned. I'll finish it in a minute.